Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with Aurora Theatre Artistic Director Tom Ross and veteran Bay actor, director, and teacher Robert Parsons. We'll share details about the Aurora's current production, A Bright New Boise. Conductor Cyrus Janwala's in studio to offer a preview of this weekend's Bay Area Rainbow Symphony concerts. Critic at large Diane Keough shares her take on some regional theater productions. And Peter Robinson also stops by with some news on Macbeth and other cultural happenings. Stay with us. Mendelssohn to start a bright afternoon of Open Air off this week. You'll hear Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto with soloist Jason Todorov this weekend with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony under guest conductor Cyrus Janwala. That recording, by the way, was Hilary Hahn and the Frankfurt Radio Symphony. Cyrus Janwala, conductor, joins me in studio to talk about the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony and the program this weekend. Cyrus, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
So, Jason Todorov is the soloist for Mendelssohn on a program that also includes works by Kenton Coe and Benjamin Britten in this Britten centenary year. Let's start with the soloist, Jason Todorov. Tell us a little bit about him.
Jason Todorov is a Bulgarian violinist. He came to the United States when he was in high school and studied at Idlewild in Southern California, up in that beautiful Alpine setting, and he has established a career as a recitalist all over the world. He's just released a new recording of Bach solo works, and he's also my colleague at San Francisco State, where he teaches violin. So I've had the pleasure of getting to know him as a person as well as a musician.
Well, it seems to be San Francisco State radio this past couple of weeks. I had your other colleague, the conductor of your wind ensemble.
Oh, Martin Zagelke. Yes.
Great guy.
Yeah.
Let's see what we can have next week.
Well, as people know, I think, State has roots all over the community. I always say you can't walk 5 feet in San Francisco without tripping over a State alum.
Right.
So they're everywhere.
Well, it's interesting, too, that the SF State is the home of the Alexander String Quartet.
And
we broadcast on Monday another tie-in here on Explorations in Music, that wonderful series they do through SF Performances with Robert Greenberg. So it really is quite a breeding ground and quite an incredible staff and faculty at SF State. So this program, the Mendelssohn, did Jason choose this work?
Jason and I had some discussions about what piece he wanted to play, and I told him sort of what we were doing in the rest of the concert. We tried to figure out something that would be complementary to the Britten and the Co., and this kind of worked out. We tossed it around, and it worked out to be really well thematically, I think, with the rest of the program. The Kenton Coe piece is unknown to most people in the West Coast. I hope this will spur a greater interest in his music. And then Benjamin Britten is sort of a beloved classic, which is mostly performed on children's concerts, but also has a life of its own as an orchestral piece, and we'll talk about that in a minute.
Right, right. Speaking of Kenton Coe, I'm so happy to be introduced to the music of Kenton Coe, completely off my radar. He's a composer out of Tennessee.
He is.
Born in 1930, who takes his Appalachian upbringing to his melodies and themes. But this work that we're doing this weekend, full disclosure here, I do play with the Bay Area Rainbows, a blatant plug away here
right.
for bars today. This work, Ischiana Overture, takes its inspiration from elsewhere.
It does. It does. There's an island near Capri off the coast of Italy called Ischia.
Ischia.
And so this is the name of the overture. Ischiana is a sort of evocation of the kind of bright, sparkling, Mediterranean Sea and that climate. And it resulted from a visit that he had. He went to visit the composer William Walton, the English composer, had a home there. He sort of made it his home in the later part of his life. And so it became kind of a center for music and composers. And so Kenton established, I think through just letter writing, actually, some contact with them, and ended up spending some time there. And he had such pleasant memories of it that it resulted in this overture.
Quite a neat work. It's really something to hear an excerpt.
And evocative of Walton, too. I think quite intentionally it evokes those kind of bright, sparkly overtures that Walton is known for, the concert overtures.
Let's hear a little bit of the music of Kenton Coe. This is actually a field recording made, what, about 12 hours ago.
Yes, it is fresh.
In Knuth Hall at San Francisco State. This is the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony dress rehearsing some of the music of Kenton Coe in the Ischiana Overture. go. And taking as its inspiration the tiny island just southwest of Naples, about 18 square miles in total geography, Ischia, the Ischiana Overture by composer Kenton Coe. It's a work that we heard here in rehearsal of the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony to be performed this Saturday at 8, Sunday at 4 at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, O'Farrell at Geary. Cyrus Janwala, guest conducting the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, joining me in studio to talk. It really is a really evocative piece.
It is. I love Kenton's music, and he's written a lot in various forms. He's got a wonderful oboe concerto, an oboe sonata. He's written a lot of church music, actually. A church in Palo Alto commissioned him to write an anthem, which was premiered here about 6 months ago. And it's really, really fun music.
I learned that his opera written in 1972 called South was staged by the Paris Opera, and it remains the only opera by an American composer ever performed by
yes,
that company.
Yes, it is. It is, and it's amazing because it almost didn't happen. There's a little story which I put in the program notes about this as well, but Kenton lived in Paris for a number of years in the 50s and then moved to New York in the 60s, and he became acquainted with the actor John Gielgud through mutual friends. And when the Paris Opera agreed to do this commission, one of the caveats was that Kenton had to bear the cost of producing the orchestral parts, which in those days before Xerox machines was really expensive. And so he was absolutely downtrodden. He thought that the premiere wouldn't happen. And he happened to pass John Gielgud on the street in New York. And Gielgud said, why are you so downcast? And Kenton told him. And Gielgud, a few days later, agreed to pay for the production of the orchestra parts for South, and that's how it got premiered at the Paris Opera.
Wow, that is an interesting bit of table talk trivia there.
Almost didn't happen.
And another opera, a fascinating topic, on the wife of Andrew Jackson called Rachel.
Yes, indeed. That was, I think that one was premiered in the United States, actually. That might have been a Tennessee Bicentennial Commission, actually. But yeah, his writing for the voice is terrific. The orchestra that I was the music director of in Tennessee actually commissioned an overture called Appalachian Quilt from him for their 50th anniversary, so I premiered that in the first season that I was there.
Mm, very nice. Now, the Benjamin Britten work we're performing is widely known as The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, where Benjamin Britten borrowed a theme by composer Henry Purcell and wrestled with it in various ways as a sort of introductory work in various sections, siphoning out the winds, the brass, and everyone having their moment in the sun. And I think it's the only second such didactic symphonic work in the repertoire next to Peter and the Wolf. It's probably written in as a response to that. Mm-hmm. But, of course, now we have Nathaniel Stuckey's wonderful The Composer is Dead that is also serving that function.
Right.
Now, Britten himself wanted that to be done either with narrator or without. He wrote the narration.
He did. It was originally, the piece was written as a film score, actually. The British Film Unit commissioned him right after World War II to produce a film to introduce school kids to the instruments of the orchestra. So originally, as it appeared, there was an orchestra in the film, and the narration was spoken and the music was played. So it was originally conceived with the narration, but when it was published, Britten included some alternate passages so that you could turn it into a purely orchestral work without including the narration. And fortunately, it works very well in that way. It has a nice shape and flow to it, and a lot of content, beyond just simply sampling out the various sections for the benefit of the audience.
It's quite a virtuosic work, too. It's not a walk in the park by any means for the players.
It isn't. It's really, I call it a concerto for orchestra. That form was originally designed to show off the orchestra, as a complete body and also in its sections, and this really does that. I mean, every player in the orchestra has at least one juicy moment, and it's even without the narration, it's pretty obvious what section Britten is talking about at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're doing it quite differently. We're actually calling the work something different, bringing in your own narrative that you've developed through the writings of Britten and some contemporary headlines.
Right.
Which kind of ties in with the whole part of the mission statement of Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, which is in part to promote gay and lesbian composers and performers.
Right.
Britten celebrating his centenary year, quite a different view of homosexuality in Britten while he was being a professional in his younger days.
Right. He was, Britten lived quite remarkably in one of the most homophobic periods in either Britain or America, which was the 50s. And during that time, for a total of about 35 years, he was his life partner, Peter Peers, also became his muse and a frequent performer of his work. So we had this fairly open couple living at a time from about the late 1930s until Britain's death in 1976, I think, in a model which, you know, it's hard to imagine how heroic that was at the time. He really could have, it could have destroyed his career for somebody who made their living purely off composing and not as a teacher at that time. It was a very delicate career to manage. And the fact that he lived openly with Peter Pears, I think, is remarkable. So we're really pleased to celebrate that. And as you mentioned, the narration comes from letters which were published. The two of them wrote a lot, as people did in the days before telephoning became really easy. And there were six volumes of letters that were published gradually over the period after Peter Pears died, I think, in 1986, maybe. And these letters are very intimate. It really details the private life and the, you know, in some ways it's remarkable. In other ways, you find out that it was just basically like any other long-term relationship. They had their rough patches, and they had frequent periods of separation because Pears was on tour and Britain was taking commissions and traveling around the world. And so we tried to tease out from this in just the tiniest sampling of letters over the course of the time that they were partnered together.
It starts off, I just learned last night, hearing some of the narration that's being done wonderfully by Neil Sharp and Drew Pauling, by the way, will be part of these performances this weekend. Starts off with interesting headlines from some of the artistic powers that be of Britain wanting to purge the opera and the music establishment of the disruptive and homosexual element.
Yes, it was kind of, I guess, artistic McCarthyism, if you will. Mm. But it's kind of deliciously ironic in a way, because one of the people who's quoted is referred to as the famous composer Mr. Walford Davies, and I defy anybody to quote to me a work by the famous composer Walford Davies who has been consigned to the dustbin of history.
Right.
But clearly everyone was jumping on the bandwagon. You know, this periodically happened throughout the 20th century and even before, where there would be these sudden upswells of just crazy homophobia and these purges of people. And this was apparently during one of those times. So the newspaper article sort of helps frame the narrative around, you know, the world in which they were living, which I think makes it that much more remarkable.
There's also a bit of controversy, or shall we say regarding Britain's pacifism during the war and his move to England at a time when England was literally being bombarded.
Yeah. So Britain and Pears left England right before the war broke out there, and there was some public criticism of them at the time. They came to America. They were here for about 3 years and then ended up going back during the war, actually, before the peace was declared. And there was some thought that he would suffer, that people would accuse him of being unpatriotic. You could dissect it endlessly. It turned out to be quite good for Britain's career because he met the director of the Boston Symphony, Serge Koussevitzky, who ended up commissioning him for Peter Grimes, his great opera, which ended up putting him on the map. It was performed dozens of times in the years following, and it really made his reputation as a composer. And of course, he, as soon as he got back to Britain, he was commissioned to write The Young Person's Guide, which we have today, so I guess it was good that he went back when he did.
That's fascinating. And he was also befriended and was influenced by Aaron Copland while he was here.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think part of the reason he came out here was a couple of his colleagues, very good friends, W.H. Auden and Christopher Isherwood, had preceded him to America.
Yeah, and I think people told him that musical life in England at that time was really not a place where he was going to make a reputation as a composer, which I think was largely true. The structure of English music, you know, since World War II is radically different than it was before, and there wasn't much structured classical music going on there, surprisingly. People remember the recordings of Beecham and Barbaroli, but the musical life itself was not really thriving there in the way that it is now.
So talk, if you can, about Britain's rehabilitation of his reputation in England, since he was at one point very much disparaged critically and artistically.
Yes, so this is a complicated question. All politics is local and all politics is personal, and it certainly was true in Britain's case. Strangely, I think surprisingly to him, when Queen Elizabeth was crowned, I think in 1952, they commissioned Britain to write an opera. I think what they were expecting was something that would be in the mold of a very staid kind of celebratory historic piece about the grandeur of the English monarchy. And so he was kind of surprised that commission came his way, given the fact that there was this controversy about his pacifism. He didn't really help the cause much because he produced a very personal opera about the life of Queen Elizabeth I, which he called Gloriana. And on the opening night, the audience was kind of stunned to see on the stage an English monarch being portrayed as a conflicted person who was in a love affair. And it didn't go over so well initially. It took a while for that opera to actually find its place in the repertoire, and it's never been as popular as some of his other works. But I think, you know, what really won it the case for Britain was his music. The music is irresistible. It's well-written, it's heartfelt, it's fascinating to perform, it's gratifying to perform, and it's fun to listen to, especially in the case of the piece that we're doing. It has a kind of delightful aspect to it. It ends in a kind of triumphant mode after beginning in the minor, and it's irresistible.
We'll hear a touch of that in a moment. That's Cyrus Jinwala. He's conducting the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony Orchestra this Saturday at 8, Sunday at 4, St. Mark's Lutheran Church, O'Farrell at Geary here in San Francisco. On the program, Benjamin Britten's Variations and Fugue on a Theme of Purcell, which is now being called for this production Letters from a Life, featuring letters and period pieces with Neil Sharp and Drew Pauling as narrators. Also, Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto with Yasin Todorov. Tickets and information at bars-sf.org. I'm going to offer some tickets to that performance either Saturday or Sunday now, and you call us here in studio, 415-841-4134. Area code 415-841-4134. We have five pairs of tickets for either Saturday or Sunday, or a single ticket if you prefer to come alone. St. Mark's Lutheran this Saturday and Sunday. 415-841-4134. Still to come this hour on Open Air, I'll be talking with some folks from Aurora Theater about a bright new Boise. Peter Robinson is also here to talk some critical theater. Also, Diane Keough offers her take on some theater offerings. 415-841-4134 for tickets to the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony this weekend. Cyrus, thanks for taking a little bit of time with us today. I'm sure you're looking forward to a couple of terrific performances.
I am indeed. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And let's hear, actually, Benjamin Britten conducting his own work. This is A Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, however you want to call it, Variations and Fugue on a Theme of Purcell. Music of Benjamin Britten here on Open Air. Again, tickets for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, call 415-841-4134. Thanks again, Cyrus.
Thank you.
Opening of The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, music of Benjamin Britten, Variations and Fugue on a Theme of Henry Purcell. This weekend, entitled Letters from a Life, featuring narrators Drew Pauling and Neil Sharp. Cyrus Jinwala conducting the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. Tickets at bars-sf.org, or we do still have a couple of pairs remaining if you'd like to call us here in studio, 841-4134. Good afternoon once again. David Latulippe with you for Open Air, our cultural calendar and highlight show here on every Thursday afternoon on KALW, your local public radio station. Welcoming once again to the airwaves, Diane Keough with some cultural happenings. Hi, Diane.
Hi. It's good to be back. Last week, I was listening to the program, and you really covered the things that were going on at with I Married an Angel, which was a great play, great fun play. But two things I didn't think I heard mentioned, and one was that the lead, played by Sean Thompson, and he's still playing until the 17th, he looked exactly like Gavin Newsom.
Oh, really?
And we were sitting in the audience, and I couldn't get over it because I kept thinking, who is it? Who is it? And the person next to me said, looks like Gavin Newsom. And I said, sure does. And so there was Gavin for the rest of the play up on stage, singing, dancing, and acting. There was one other thing about that play that I wanted to say, that Anna Murphy, who was really Alcee Verade, the gossip who caused so much trouble and made me dislike her, was a great actress to be able to get that kind of a reaction out of me. She was also the dance captain, and she was a terrific tap dancer. You don't see tap dancing much anymore, and it was really nice to see it in that program.
Very nice.
And they're running until the 17th.
Right. Information at 42ndStreetMoon.org. I Married an Angel.
And next comes Guys and Dolls, a great American
classic. Oh, boy.
American theater. It's just, it's wonderful. American musical theater at its best. And it is playing presently at Broadway by the Bay. And for those of you who don't, I'll try to give a very fast description of what it's about. It's set in New York, and a delightful cast of ne'er-do-well bookies, gamblers, and a lovely missionary, Kelly Britt, who plays Sarah Brown, the missionary staff and a marching band who are all out to save the lives of the sinners. Characters named Nathan Detroit, Nicely Nicely, Big Julie, Joey Biltmore, Harry the Horse, Angel the Ox, Liver Lips Louie, and our anti-hero, Jack Mossbacker, who plays Sky Masterson. I mean, it's just, the cast is terrific. The last time that I saw Jack Mossbacker on stage, he was playing Rum Tum Tigger in Cats, and he owned the stage when he was on it. He's a graduate of Stanford. Great voice. In one of the scenes, Miss Adelaide, who could easily be a steam stealer because she is so good and her voice is so correct for that kind of a performance, because she's the star of the Hotbox Girls, and she's in love with Nathan Detroit. She's been engaged to him for 14 years and seems to be having a problem getting him to say, okay, let's get married, because he's constantly looking for a new crap game. And the show it's just wonderful. It goes on. It's all the things you expect. The music, the words by Frank Lesser are incredible.
It really is something.
And it's fun because they're singable, but you can hear the words. Broadway by the Bay will be running through the 17th with this show.
Information at broadwaybythebay.org. Another organization near and dear to my heart is on your hit list here, the Peninsula Symphony at Stanford, and the Stanford Symphonic Chorus coming up at Bing.
Yeah, it's going to be at Bing, which I think is so great. November 22nd and 24th, a Friday and a Sunday, which is an unusual thing for the symphony. But I'm looking forward to it. First of all, I'm looking forward to going to Bing.
Yeah, I haven't been either. It'd be my first time performing there as well, under the baton of Mitchell Klein, doing Ernest Bloch's Sacred Service, as well as the Concerto Grosso Number 1 with Juliana Ma at the piano. It's going to be quite a program.
It should be. And yesterday I met the second violinist, who was quite a delightful person, and we chatted about the upcoming show, and she was excited about going to Bing as well.
PeninsulaSymphony.org.
PeninsulaSymphony.org, and I can't wait for their January performance. That is going to be great fun. Just as a slight teaser, it's going to be a jazz pianist. And
Taylor Eigsti comes.
Taylor
Eigsti,
local boy, made really, really, really good.
He's a super guy, too.
So anyway, I wanted to talk about some coming attractions, and we're going to start with Evita, which is going to be in San Jose Performing Arts Center November 19th through the 24th. Then we can go on to Snoopy, who will be at 42nd Street Moon, the Eureka Theater, from November 27th through December 15th.
That should be a fun little holiday show to catch. Again, 42ndStreetMoon.org.
It's a great family show. The Peninsula Youth Ballet is doing the Nutcracker at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center, November 30th, December 1st, 7th, and 8th. They've been doing this, the Children's Theater, since 1979, so they're well established in that area. Something unusual, Little Women, the musical, which I had never heard of, will be at Theater Works at Lucy Stern Center in Palo Alto from the 4th to the 29th of December.
Have you seen that musical before?
No.
As a musical, interesting.
I have. Have you?
No, I have not.
I'm kind of looking forward to it. I'm not a great fan of Louisa May Alcott's work. It just isn't my thing, but still...
But when it's sung...
when it's sung, it's different. And then we have the Notre Dame de Namur in Belmont, which is their Christmas Carol, their annual show that they've been putting on for years. It's free with a donation of food or a new toy. So it's something to look forward to. It's the kind of thing that you go to see every year. You know it's the same cast. It's the same show. It's not going to change. And everybody just loves it because you end up singing Christmas carols at the end with tears in your eyes, and it's really a happy time. And then we have Viva La Musica, their holiday concert at St. Peter's Church in Redwood City, December 8th and 15th. And then we have Smoon Ballet. Now, they're going to be all over the place. They're going to be in Walnut Creek from November 22nd and 23rd. Then they're going to be in Carmel, December 6th and 7th. Then they will be in Mountain View, December 11th through 15th. And they're at Yerba Buena, December 18th to the 28th. And that's another one. The Smoon Ballet is another one that puts on an annual show. It doesn't change the second half of the show. It did last year by one number. Everybody got upset. You go back to see the same thing you've seen for years, and you enjoy it just as much. So I'm really looking forward to a great holiday time for the family as well as just for individuals.
Your dance card is full, I should say, Diane.
It is indeed, and that's a nice thing.
Thanks so much for stopping by and
sharing. It's been great.
And speaking of theater, a bright new Boise opens tonight at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. It's called A Funny, Compassionate, and Disturbing All at Once play by the LA Weekly. It's the recipient of the 2011 Obie Award for Playwriting and a 2011 Drama Desk nomination for Best Play. Opens tonight at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. It stars Bay Area veteran actor, director, and teacher Robert Parsons, who is also lead actor in the production, and the Aurora's artistic director and director of A Bright New Boise, Tom Ross, joins me in studio as well. Gentlemen, welcome back to KLW.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here.
So I need to ask first, Tom Ross, how did you first come across the work of this playwright, Samuel Hunter?
Well, when you're an artistic director of a company, you are always, you know, every morning I wake up and I get on the internet and I just start reading reviews across the country. And Samuel Hunter is a hot young playwright. He's written a number of plays, but this play that came out in 2011 or 10, won the award in 11, was the play that really put him on the map. So, I read about him in the New York Times and elsewhere. The play has been performed in Chicago and L.A. and Portland and a number of cities. This is the first time the Bay Area is going to be able to see his work, though.
What is the play about?
The play is about, it takes place in Boise, and that's the state that Sam Hunter is from. He writes all of his plays about Idaho so far. They all take place there. And it's about an evangelical Christian named Will, who is on a mission, which is to bond with his son before the end of the world. He believes that the rapture is impending, and he had given up his son as a baby. And so he gets a job at a Hobby Lobby store. Hobby Lobby is actually a real chain of craft stores in the United States. I thought it was a made-up name at first, but it's actually a chain, and it's actually run by a Christian organization. So it's a big Christian money-making, big-box Walmart kind of a chain. And he gets a job at a store where his son is working to create a relationship with him again.
Robert Parsons, this is set in Idaho, in Boise. You've had some schooling in Idaho. Now, I'm wondering if there are any parallels within the play and your character.
I don't know where that comes from. Actually, I've been to Idaho, but I did not actually go to school there.
Okay.
So, I think the setting is... I think Samuel Hunter puts it there because he knows that world. And he understands the people there. I think he grew up and went to high school in Boise and attended a Christian high school. And he felt like, I think his parents felt as though that was the place where he could get the best education. And so he was, you know, mingling with a lot of these people that he ends up writing about in this play. And I think he's trying to give a really balanced sort of human look at what many people think is sort of a fringe fanatical element. And Will is just a sort of a regular guy that is trying to rebond with his son, has sort of problems and issues and obstacles just like the rest of us. And also, of course, has this belief that the rapture is upon us soon, hopefully in his mind. And I think he wants to sort of have his feet in both of these worlds. So it's a very balanced sort of sober look at sort of what we see or think of as a sort of fanatical sect.
Mm. So what sort of research did you do for preparing for the role? Did you find aspects of him that you like and dislike as you've learned the character?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a religious family. My father was an Episcopalian minister, so I don't know
how I confused that with Idaho. I'm sorry.
That's easily done. But I understand growing up in a churched family. I think the evangelical part of it was new to me. I read the books. What's the name of the
Left Behind
Left Behind books, books, right? Mm-hmm. That are very, very popular evangelical Christian novels. I think there's 13 of them. I read the first one. And actually, the character Will is also writing a similar book online. He has a blog, but it's sort of an online novel that's very, very closely related. But so anyway, tell me the original question again. I'm sorry, I went on a tangent.
Well, either relating to the character or preparing for him. There are parts of the character that you can really like, or are there parts that make you kind of cringe?
Yeah, I like the humanness of the guy. He's very, very, I think, a very sympathetic character. And, you know, it's hard to understand where the fanaticism comes from sometimes. But I think what Samuel Hunter does beautifully is shows how it's possible to believe these things. And I think in Will's case, he's a guy that's been through a pretty traumatic situation up in northern Idaho with his other church. And there was a thing that happened up there. And his life has really come sort of to a grounding halt. And he's got to figure out a way to keep going forward. And one of the things that keeps him going forward is this belief that something better is out there. And in his mind, it's the rapture, where if he's true to his beliefs and his faith, that he will ascend and, you know, be in this beautiful place for eternity and then reform and come back as a whole person. So I think you can sort of understand it when you see it in this way, because somebody that has nothing or feels like their life is sort of miserable in certain ways has something to glom onto, hold on to, and attach to. So that's sort of where I've gone with it, to try to get inside that headspace.
You're the primary character for the play. What are the other supporting characters that are involved?
Beautifully played by Gwen Loeb, Megan Trout, Patrick Russell, and Daniel Petzold. Daniel playing my son, Alex, who's been adopted out of our church, the church that Will ran at about 2 months old, and has grown up in this other family, and he's got a lot of problems and issues. He's an artist and a musician. Then there's Gwen Loeb, who plays Pauline, who's the store manager and very interested in keeping the place running and together. Megan Trout is one of the employees, plays Anna, sort of a quirky interesting, weird girl that Will and Anna sort of have a thing, not a, a romantic relationship, but a spiritual and bonding in, during the play. And then Patrick Russell, who's another employee of the store, who's sort of the opposite pole to Will, who's very in your face and sort of carries the humor of the play. The other characters carry a lot of the humor, actually.
Tom Russ, tell us what we're going to see in the production. How did you decide to set the play?
The play takes place in basically two locations. It's the break room of the Hobby Lobby. Samuel Hunter said he wanted to. He also, as Robert was saying, he went to a Christian high school, but simultaneously he was working at a Walmart. So this play sort of is bringing those two ideas together. And so the, he also thinks the idea of a break room is a great space for a play because it's an awkward space where there's no reason for people to be talking to each other or getting together except that they work at the same place. So mostly it takes place in kind of a stark, fluorescent-y break room and up the parking lot in front of the Hobby Lobby where Will periodically goes to call upon the rapture to occur.
So you've been in preview this past week. What did you discover in preview?
Wow, what have we discovered in previews? We discovered that there's a lot of laughter in the play. Uh-huh. It's a really interesting mix of sort of the tragic, and, as well as very funny. The idea of a man like Will, a very pious man like Will, being in the middle of a Hobby Lobby with a lot of foul-mouthed, typical people. There's something odd about that juxtaposition. Also, we've... what else have we learned? What else would you say we've learned?
I think we've learned that it seems to land on audiences very differently. It hasn't been a necessarily a consistent response so far. I mean, how many shows have we done so far?
Four.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a small sample size, but it seems like it's landing on people differently, which is great. I think it's a play that doesn't have necessarily, it's not a Neil Simon where you go 1, 2, 3, bang, that's the laugh. Mm. Here it's, you know, some people are going to respond in certain ways and others are going to respond differently. So it's a nice mix of different responses, and I think that's what we're going to be counting on for the run.
That's Robert Parsons. He's starring in a bright new Boise, a fairly new play by Samuel Hunter, being directed by our artistic theater director, Tom Ross, at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. Tom, what's coming up next for you? Are you doing some more directing or just lying back and enjoying the rest of the season?
I'm not lying back at all. I pretty much just direct one show a year now. I used to direct two, but I like to share the wealth. And we do 5 shows a year, so I like to give opportunities to other artists in the Bay Area as well. So I'm not directing anymore. But the next show that's coming up, the regular play, is a play called Gideon's Knot by a woman named Jonna Adams. It's a very, I think it might be one of the most controversial plays we've ever done. It's a real-time play about a parent-teacher conference from hell, where a mother has come into the school to talk to the teacher about why her son has been suspended. And it just goes to all sorts of just really intense places, bullying, homosexuality, censorship, living in a litigious world where you're afraid to talk about anything. It's a really provocative play.
Well, it's coming up. You can learn more at the Aurora Theater website, Aurora Theater. That's theaterre.org. Robert Parsons, is it what? On to the Book of Mormon after this? Or
something? Yeah, I got to polish up my pipes, but... I'm always looking for my next job. That's the beauty of being an actor. You know, sometimes you have a year planned out, and sometimes you don't. So I'm auditioning and
looking at the back pages of Backstage.
There you have it. Yep.
There we go.
Life of the actor.
A Bright New Boise at the Aurora Theater by Samuel D. Hunter, featuring Robert Parsons, directed by Tom Ross. Opens tonight. It's been in preview this past week, and it runs through December 8th. Information at the Aurora Theater, which is located at 2081 Addison Street in Berkeley, at Aurora Theater, Aurora, theatre.org.
It's the pretentious spelling.
The right and proper spelling.
Yes,
of theater. Gentlemen, I wish you a successful run, and let's have you back on the next one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Speaking of theater, but in a different way, we have Peter Robinson to round things out on Open Air today. Peter, welcome back to our airwaves.
Good to be here, David.
And we're seeing some theater, but not exactly live theater. Or is it live theater?
Well, I consider it very, very live. But in fact, you're right. It is the London National Theatre. And it is now being presented in screen form. You can see it at two different places. One is the Kabuki here in San Francisco, and the other is the Lark Theatre in Marin, in Larkspur. And the two productions that I've really enjoyed, the first is Kenneth Branagh appearing as Macbeth, and then the second is a new play by Alan Bennett called The Habit of Art. I'll start with Kenneth Branagh, who we may recall some of his greatest Shakespeare achievements have been both Henry V and Hamlet, all on screen. And this time, with the new forms of digital photography, he is a very bloody general military type of Macbeth. And a couple of interesting things about the setting. This was first produced in a deconsecrated church in Manchester, in the north of England. So the action takes place in between two lines of pews. It's almost like a corridor. And the audience were pre-warned not to wear clothing that might get dirty. So they are part of the action. The floor is muddy, which gives you a feeling for the bogs of Scotland. And the sword fighting, which is an integral piece of this story, is really man-to-man, fist against fist, sword against sword. And you could see in the film some of the audience actually backing back. They didn't want to get involved in the destruction.
Well, I hope they at least provided some scotch during intermission.
Well, they needed it because it is sometimes actually referred to as the Scottish play. And I think that's interesting about Macbeth. It has a kind of haunting ghost quality which applies to the actors in the many different versions that have since been produced.
We should also mention that in this particular production, Sir Kenneth Branagh is also acting as director. And the music that's being done in this production is by Patrick Doyle. And Branagh worked with Doyle by commissioning the score for Henry V as well, which was conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. And they've also worked on other pictures, including Much Ado About Nothing, Hamlet as well.
So, yes, and the music, you're quite right, is an integral piece of the setting because it's got a sort of sacred quality to it. There are lots of burning candles amidst the it's an altar which can turn into a bed, which can turn into a table. And the opening scene when the three witches fly out of the windows almost, we remember that opening scene, double double toil and trouble, and you're into the impact of ghosts and how the past can come back to haunt. It's a play about ambition, and it's a delicate balance between a highly sexual Lady Macbeth, who in some ways urges on Macbeth, and Macbeth, this brisk military commander, maybe a little less pensive and more in the speaking style of a general who's used to giving orders. And I think that's a key to understanding the play. Act first and think about it later. Kill first and then worry about the concerns. And of course, it is the story of regicide. It's the story of a king being killed based on a prophecy from the witches. And a lot of crits focus on that speech. Is this a dagger which I see before me? But I think by far the more important speech in this play, and particularly the way Kenneth Branagh delivers it, is the tomorrow and tomorrow, which I find a very haunting speech. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And that, to me, in many ways sums up this highly dramatic production, Cast 25, where you will get the blood and the gory, and Shakespeare is, above all, what I call an action Macbeth.
And actually, you mentioned that it is at the Kabuki, and you can bring a scotch into the screening. So there you go.
You can bring a scotch into the screening. But the other advantage of the Kabuki, and a lot of London crits remarked on this, the pews in the church were very hard on the buttocks. So the audience had to stretch and stand, but there is no interval. In the Kabuki, you have soft chairs, and you can gradually weld into the feeling of a night at the haunted castle where Duncan gets his, so they say in the business.
So not just Shakespeare from National Theatre Live, but some works of other playwrights as well, Alan Bennett particularly.
Yeah, absolutely true. And Alan Bennett is certainly the hot ticket in London. He has done a lot of very funny plays. Some of them have been used on PBS here. And this one is called The Habit of Art. And early on in the program today, you were talking about Benjamin Britten. This is a fictitious meeting between W.H. Auden, the poet, and Benjamin Britten. They did collaborate on one piece in 1941. They never really got together after that. So this is the old W.H. Auden. He's now retired to England. He has a special room given to him at Christ Church College, Oxford. He is the sort of poet in residence, the wise man of his time. He is reflective, he is grumpy, and played in this case by Richard Griffiths. And people may well remember him as the school teacher in The History Boys. I really love The History Boys. I thought that was a great impact on how history should be taught and how students react and respond to it.
Let me just back up a moment regarding the W.H. Auden Benjamin Britten connection. The collaboration, at least Britten used Auden's letters for his incredible work, the War Requiem, which is being done next week with the San Francisco Symphony.
Yeah, so that's right. So, but they did have this kind of falling out in 1941. And this is a fictitious recreation of how they could get back together again. But it's also a play within a play. So you're actually seeing a play in rehearsal form. And Benjamin Britten comes in through the door halfway through. But unknown to Benjamin Britten, a rent boy has arrived at W.H. Auden's apartment for different purposes other than discussing playwriting. And
judiciously put for our radio audiences theater in the afternoon.
Well, we want to include everybody.
Alex Jennings is playing Benjamin Britten in this production.
So it is a very humorous play. There's poetry in the play. There's certainly music. There's a piano in the play. And I think this really speaks to Alan Bennett. You may recall Alan Bennett was one of the original members of Beyond the Fringe with Peter Moore, Dudley Cooke, and Jonathan Miller. So he has that, I won't say vaudeville, but he has that music hall quality, which is, as a subtext, has a great deal of seriousness to it. And it is the comparison between music, what makes opera, what works musically, and, of course, what works poetically, and in this case, what works theatrically. So for both these productions, whether you want to see Macbeth or The Habit of Art, or some of the other upcoming Shakespeare productions, Coriolanus and Othello, you do need to check the schedule both at the Kabuki and at the Lark, because they are not running night after night on a regular schedule. Tickets are hard to come by, but they are well worth the productions. That's the National Theatre production of Macbeth with Kenneth Branagh and the new Alan Bennett play, Habit of Art.
Well, thank you very much for those recommendations, Peter. We did mention earlier in the show that it is Aaron Copland's birthday today, and I thought as a nice tribute to tying in the death of John Taverner as well. We heard earlier this week, John Taverner dead at the age of 69, the anniversary of Aaron Copland's birth. I thought I'd offer a little bit of Copland to round things out here on Open Air. Here is Aaron Copland's 8 poems of Emily Dickinson. We'll hear, appropriately, I think, the track Going to Heaven. And we'll hear Marnie Nixon and Keith Clark conducting the Pacific Symphony Orchestra. Music of Aaron Copland in tribute to his birthday and as a tribute to the recent demise of John Taverner.
Going to heaven, going to heaven.
Marnie Nixon singing the Aaron Copland song, Going to Heaven. Happy birthday, Aaron Copland, and rest in peace, John Tavener. Marnie Nixon, most known for her voice as singing the voice of Deborah Kerr in The King and I, Natalie Wood in West Side Story, and Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. Quite a talent herself. From Eight Poems of Emily Dickinson, we heard Marnie Nixon singing with Keith Clark and the Pacific Symphony Orchestra. I'm David Latulip. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. A reminder that all of our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkles, my producer, for helping run things smoothly during this production. And join me next week at the same time. And join me Monday evening at 9 for Explorations in Music. Our latest incarnation of that show, produced by Eric Wayne, it's with the Alexander String Quartet once again and the wonderful historian, I want to say comedian slash historian, Robert Greenberg, is exploring the music of Benjamin Britten, among other composers, and the string quartet in a time of war. That's Monday evenings in November and December here on KALW, Mondays at 9. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next week. I'm David LaTulipe.